Okay, so here's my collaborators, including Junko and Matt, who are here. Okay, so as you can probably guess from the title, first of all, I'll be talking about upsilon spectroscopy and then going on to talking about BDKs. And it turns out that this is sort of quite a good order to do things in, because if you do the upsilon spectrum work first, then you're able to fix the parameters, the bottom quark mass and the lattice spacing, which need to be fixed for the important BDK calculations. And also, by comparing other quantities to experiment quantities that we've not used to fix these, we can give ourselves confidence that our heavy quark methods are working. Okay, so as I say, I'll talk about the upsilon spectrum first, and then I'll move on to the BDKs. With regards to the BDKs, we need a precision calculation of the of FB and the bag parameter B sub B. Junko talked about this yesterday, in order to pin down the CKM parameters. In particular, it's this combination that we want. And the overall aim is to reduce the theory errors to a few percent, otherwise they will dominate the uncertainties from experiment. And here's a quick slide on motivation. So these graphs are showing the different constraints on the point rho eta, where rho and eta are CKM parameters. Now, okay, the top left is the picture today, or at least a few years ago. I think this was 2001, this picture. And you can see that there's still quite big errors here. But if we, this is, the point is that a large part of these errors are theoretical and not experimental. If we had 2 to 3% theory errors today, the picture would look a lot better. And then with better experiments, you might be looking one day at something like this. The aim is to over-constrain the point rho eta to reveal any inconsistencies within the standard model, which would point to new physics. Okay, so for each of the epsilon and B decay calculations, we've used the Milk ensembles, which use the improved staggered formulation. There's been a lot of talk already about the improved staggered formulation in the fourth route. I'm not going to talk any more about that. So these configurations include 2+1 flavors of dynamical quarks, where the 2 corresponds to the up and down light quarks, and the 1 corresponds to the strange quark. The up and down quarks have got masses down to as low as the strange quark over 8. There's 2 values of lattice spacing, so-called coarse lattices and so-called fine lattices. And we fixed the 5 parameters of QCD using, as I say, these upsilon quantities, and then the light and strange quarks are fixed, and the Chal quarks are fixed using these quantities. Okay, so we use these quantities to fix these parameters because they're so-called gold-plated quantities, which means easy to calculate quantities. And then the idea is to compute other gold-plated quantities to compare with experiment, and as a test of our methods. Okay, so heavy quarks on the lattice. B quarks typically have low velocities within the meson, which is a good thing because it means we can use the effective theory of lattice NRQCD, which is an expansion of the Lagrangian in powers of V squared. And if we do this, the calculation of the quark green functions becomes more simplistic. It can be done using an evolution equation instead of having to solve a boundary value Dirac problem. And this enables us to to get high statistics by doing more simulations. Now, going on to the upsilon system, just to remind people, it's a bound state of the bottom and anti-bottom, which can be labeled by these quantum numbers N and L. For example, the epsilon 2s is n equals 2 and l equals 0. Now, the stable states in this system are precisely known experimentally, which enables good comparison with experiment. These calculations also have the advantage that the valence quarks are not the same as the light dynamical quarks, so it gives us a good indication of how the dynamical quarks feed into the Meson properties. So we can systematically improve the Lagrangian order by ordering v squared and match the continuum, and these results use order v, the standard order v to the fourth Lagrangian with tree-level tadpole improved matching. So here's a table of the upsilon runs which have been done. The top half corresponds to the coarse lattices, and the bottom half corresponds to the fine lattices. We've done quenched and unquenched calculations on both, and there's a two-flavour calculation done on the coarse lattices as well. We've used roughly 200 configurations each time, and we've got increased statistics by running multiple origins on each configuration, either 16 or 8. So, just a quick mention of the fitting. Junko mentioned Bayesian fitting yesterday. Here's a little bit more about it. So this graph here plots the energy, resulting energies from the fit against the number of exponentials used in the fit for the epsilon 1s, 2s, and 3s. So we can see that when we use, so I should mention, before Bayesian fitting, we could only fit to maybe 2 or 3 exponentials. So to do this, you cut off the low time data to get rid of the high energy contribution. But now we're able to fit to a higher number of exponentials, so we can fit the whole range of data. So you can see with the whole range of data, for these low number of exponentials, the chi-squared is high, and these points are up here. But as we increase the number of exponentials up to nx equals 7, these plateau and the chi-squares become good. So we could equally take any one of these four fits as our final results.
Still, I'm a little bit puzzled that 7 exponentials, your results significantly deviates from the one with 5 exponentials, even though the chi's aren't, the chi is a little bit.
Well, but that tells you one has to be careful. You
don't
really do many exponentials until the chi-squares
are
also plateaued.
Yeah, I wouldn't sort of rely on the chi-squares alone. You'd have to look for this plateau as well.
You've not told us, forgive me, Ryan. You're fitting all T here, or T1 up or something.
Yeah, maybe sometimes we leave the first one off, but...
What normally one would do is to vary the team in so that the chi squared is acceptable the number of exponentials you've got.
There's no need to do that if you've got a large enough exponentials to get a good chi squared with the whole data.
I'm confused. Just how many T's are you doing? How many
the whole 16 or whatever, or 32, we've done it with both. So that you don't cut off any time slices, you use the whole data set.
And that's why you get information about what
excites you. The entire, you mean all time distances?
Including zero?
I mean, so even the thing that is the crash instead of the e to the t is included or not?
This is just exponential.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you're fitting the simple exponentials, then up to the periodicity?
It's just this.
So you go to 64 and you take 16 separate.
So we'll only run
separations from 1 to 16.
We'll only run the propagator for 16 time slices, not across the whole lattice.
16 time slices separated by 1. So separation 0, 1 up to 15. Or 1. And you fitted all of these with that series.
Yeah.
And you have some, how many numbers? 60 numbers you're fitting?
Yeah, 16 time slices. Yeah. So, we're doing multiple smearings as well.
Yeah, and each one of these
You're saying 16 members with 20. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, but with
yeah. Pincers. It doesn't make any sense.
No, no, but you don't. You only trust those lower. Those
yeah, you only trust the bottom number. But
and
I mean, it
you can put
this. It does sound like 16 members with 20. Perhaps.
20 commoners, yeah. and then you only have 16 later, right?
I mean, you're really saying that you're getting out from 16 numbers that you have measured, 18 numbers.
No, you're only.
Oh, but you're only.
No, Rx is equal 10, so I subtract one. I go from 0 to 9, which is 20, because I have C's and E's. So you got 20 numbers out of 16 with this fantastic Bayesian.
But you
yeah.
Just
but the only you only believe your lowest.
Yeah.
Prior numbers. You go most of the numbers and then you fit just the exponential as you float the higher energies.
The higher things are 100% errors.
Mm-hmm.
So
you don't trust them.
Do you know what happens if you were to fit only from 4 out? Just go through the whole procedure, just like you're doing it, but leave out the short time.
Only just 6 times.
I expect it would be slightly similar. I expect the results would be quite similar. I mean, I've done this with without using Bayesian fitting, varying team in as well, and we get the same results for the lowest energy parameters.
One thing that they're doing is that they have multiple sources, and so that means that they actually have more than because they use the same energy set. Yeah, they use the same energies.
No, it's like more configuration.
Yeah, but it's different. The C's will differ from those things.
Is that true?
You're doing.
These are 3x3 matrix fix.
You're doing it configuration to configuration, right?
No.
No.
What do you mean?
Gauge configuration to gauge configuration.
The average configuration.
Yeah,
average configuration per time slice.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You've actually got
and then you have the 60 numbers.
You've actually got 6x16 numbers you're fitting, right? Because you've got 6 numbers in your 3x3 matrix, because it's symmetric.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's the answer. It is over-constrained, though.
What
is the sense that some of us...
Well,
because we're using different smearings at source and sink.
Thank you. Is the chi-squared correlated or uncorrelated?
I think...
This is the chi-squared, the Bayesian chi-squared.
No, this is the regular chi-squared.
This is
it's a Bayesian chi-squared.
It's augment chi-square was a Bayesian.
Well, you start with the normal chi-square and add something to it. Mm-hmm. And my question was whether the normal chi-square included the correlations between the different time slices.
Yeah, we used the sort of put everything in the correlation matrix. I think so. Yeah.
And do you know how the correlation matrix was conditioned?
No, I don't know.
The eigenvalues of the correlation matrix, what the range?
I don't know, sorry, I'm just using this coordinate.
You can get 0 points very easily.
No, typically those correlation matrices have a condition number which is incredibly bad.
Yeah. You have to damp them out, otherwise it's crazy.
So if you just stick it in your code without looking at what these eigenvalues are, you are the most of higher powers.
Yeah,
but typically
you get some very low
eigenvalues.
No, well,
but
we have a
cutoff
on
that.
Well, you know what
you said to me,
but it doesn't mean
it's sensible. It gives you an answer if you use these plots, but if you really look at those correlation matrices, it's very questionable.
You've got a 96x96 matrix, and you've only got 200 samples, so you've got to be, the ranks would be a bit iffy, right?
If you do a completely simple-minded analysis, how many excited states you can measure?
I would say probably the two, but not this one.
The results are compatible.
Yeah, I've done this without the Bayesian analysis and compared the bottom two and the.
Did you look at the amplitudes of the excited states?
Yeah. What do you mean to compare with the?
Yes, for example, if the first excited states would have a larger amplitude than the ground state, would it be surprising to you?
Say that again, sorry, I don't understand.
For example, if the first excited state has an amplitude larger than the ground state, would it be surprising?
That depends on the smearing.
Yeah, yeah, I mean.
Variational smearing procedure, so that should be okay. Right?
It's not very, it's a major.
It's not very, it's a major. You just do several smearings and you make a red itself. That's not big.
It's not very, very.
You're not extremizing on the linear combination.
Not knowledge.
It's not knowledge.
Oh, yeah, because you don't know the explanation.
Okay, so so here's the results for the lattice spacing. So the idea here is to compare the different determinations of the lattice spacing from two different quantities, the orbital and radial splittings. As we know, in the quenched approximation, different quantities give different values of the lattice spacing, which leads to ambiguities. So this comparison gives good insight about the dynamical content of the configurations. So in this graph, we have the light quark mass plotted against the ratio of the inverse lattice spacing from the radial over the lattice spacing from, the orbital over the radial. So this is the quench points. So we've got the red points are the coarse lattices and the black points are the fine lattices. Squares, 2 plus 1, triangles quenched, and this is then f equals 2 diamond. And you can see for the quench points that they're not at 1. So this shows that we've got a difference in lattice spacing from each of these quantities, where if we go down to the most chiral results, these are consistent. It shows that these different determinations are consistent.
Light quark, you mean U, G, S, and
U and D.
You change all of them.
This is just U and D, which are the same. This S is fixed at.
French quark is fixed.
Yeah.
These are BMS on energy levels you're subtracting?
This is epsilon.
Oh, I see. The light quark is simply the determinant.
Yeah, it's simply a C quark.
So essentially, you say the splitting. Just you measure splitting 1P1, CS1.
Yeah. And then compare to experiment.
Compare with this one.
So we measure this, compare with experiment to extract the lattice spacing, and then do the same again for this. So we get two different lattice spacings, and then compare, and then take the ratio.
And can you actually independently say the splitting as a function of MY, quark mass?
Yeah, you see that.
Independently, not just ratio, because I cannot say what's happening with the ratio, but I know what's happening actually separately.
Well, I plot these things. You see a plot of these things in physical units, but plot of this one at least, because we use this one to fix the lattice spacing. Mm-hmm. So you see that in the next slide? No, two slides.
But you could plot just the lattice spacing as a function, and that was the question. It's a function of the quark mass to see if it changed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And presumably it does.
Yeah, I mean, the changes differently for these different quantities as you move it.
Theta is also changing too.
Well, milk has two of their lattices, the different lattices, so the lattice spaces are as close.
Ah, sorry.
When they change the dynamical
compass, they change it. Can I ask about this, about how the lattice spacing that you've got compares with a sort of radius of the ground state, that kind of thing? I mean, how well are you actually discretizing the wave function? Is it all in one lattice spacing? Or I don't have a feeling in my head for these parameters.
So the question is, what is the lattice spacing?
No, what's the radius of the ground state in terms of lattice spacing, let's say, for coarse lattices or something? Give me a feeling, is it 2 or 5,
I don't know.
Something more like,
I don't think it's right.
Long time ago, we looked at the
my feeling is it's actually root 2, and that's why I'm asking the question, but I'd like to hear the answer before I follow up.
I don't.
Depends on the speed.
You hit the
Yeah, but that's why I'm asking the ground state.
It's a critical point for any of the mothering. What is two, there's sort of two,
you have two ladder
radius of the B meson wave function?
Not B.
No, well, this is particularly the epsilon.
Epsilon is greater, right? B is epsilon small.
And the question is, you know, how hard NRQCD is having to work. And if it's having to work that hard, you should have in your NRQCD all the non-Lorentz invariant rotation, you know, non-covariant, non-Lorentz covariant bits and bobs should be in there to sort that.
Yeah.
And I'm going to, you know, I want to know if they're in there, and I want to...
What's an up wave run over A? It's the Coulomb
equation. Go ahead and you let us measure it.
So no. That's going to be what? What's A?
What's A? The lattice spacing, inverse lattice spacing is 1.6 GeV.
1.6
Yeah.
3
times.
That's the course.
And then B is 5.
So that's actually. But this is not it.
Okay, so this is a little sort of on the side. So Milk measure the lattice spacing in terms of the parameter R naught, but the problem is that the physical value of R naught is not well known. So what we've done is used our inverse lattice spacings to determine R naught. So again, here's the quenched out here and dynamical in here. And you can see R naught comes out at about 0.47. So this is the plot I was talking about a few slides ago. As I say, this is in physical units, the different energy splittings, and the 2S, 1S splitting has been used to fix the lattice spacing, so it's not there. Different colours correspond to the different splittings, and again, quench points out here, and we get more chiral down this way. The coarse are the closed symbols, and the fine are the open symbols. And you can see things are fairly flat, so we can say that the that chiral extrapolations would have little effect here.
So you say the light quark becomes larger and larger, splitting also becomes larger.
Yeah. So here's the same information again, plotted as a spectrum, except I've included this 1D state, which was just recently discovered experimentally. So we can see we've got no quench point here just because we've not done that calculation yet. And we can see we've got good agreement with experiment for the 2 plus 1 flavour results and not for the quenched results. Okay. So, as a sort of related thing here is the strong coupling constant. You can get values for the strong coupling constant by comparing non-perturbative simulations to perturbation theory for different quantities. There's 27 different quantities which have been looked at. As you mentioned, the perturbation includes third order corrections in alpha s. So here's normal Wilson loops, Kreutz ratios of Wilson loops, tadpole improved Wilson loops, and potential Heaviquark potential quantities. each of these, the simulations have been done with three different values of lattice spacing. So we've included not just the fine and the coarse, but also an extra coarse lattice, which Milk have created. So this graph here has got each of these results for alpha from each of these different three lattice spacings for each of these 27 quantities plotted against this d over a parameter. And from a fit to these, each of these, you get these different values for alpha s. And they've taken some sort of combined result, which is shown in the by the dotted lines.
Can you say
what d is? D is just it's just some integer. Do you know what it is, Junko?
Like
2 or something.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So it depends on quantity.
This is a potentially nasty question, but it's not intended like that. Because you use NRQCB, you need to calculate these corrections, and the effective action of it uses perturbations theory in a sense. So you partly put in what you're going to get out, because typically the running is sort of derivative, right? I mean, is this. So, of course, this is a self consistency check, but.
It's only for the lattice spacing. That's all. That's the only thing.
Only
to get
the. But you have bound loop corrections, right? In an NRQC.
Well, but because of the ratio plot, we know we didn't really have to use NRQCD.
Well, yeah, but you use NRQCD to get the upsilon spectrum, which is sort of like the potential, roughly speaking, and then you're getting alpha s from the potential.
Well, but then there will be loops and quotes ratios. Yeah, but that's
a little bit.
Yeah, so it's not technically true that the lattice spacing has been just been taken from the epsilon, because they've verified lattice spacings from a whole different range of quantities to show that it's consistent. Just traditionally, it's been taken from the epsilon. Okay, so now I'll move on to the B leptonic decay. This is a flashback that back to summer of 2003, Matt's talk at the Lattice Conference. So this is a graph of this ratio, which is essentially the ratio of FB sub S over FB. And on the horizontal axis, we've got MQ over MS, where Q is the valence quark. We'll see that some of these points are partially quenched, so it doesn't always equal the light C quark. So the red points are JLQCD NF equals 2 data, and these black points are the HPQCD data. Now, at this stage, it looked like there was a tantalizing hint of chiral logs, but as you can see, the errors were large, so the aim has been since then to try and reduce these statistical errors and also get more points. And this, we've used smearing similar to the epsilon to successfully do this. So again, we use the Milk configurations. As Junko talked about yesterday, we use the improved staggered light quarks. We use the same action as for the epsilon for the bottom quark, and as we said, we fixed the lattice spacing from the epsilon calculations, and we fixed the B quark mass from the epsilon simulations. Up and down in MS, we fixed by pi and k, so we've got no adjustable parameters in these calculations. And here's a table of the runs that we've done here. So we've used three different ensembles, two coarse, one fine. And for each of these, we've used several valence quark masses. So this includes partially quenched points, as I said. Now, note that the AMQ equals 0.04 corresponds to the strange quark. So that corresponds to the B sub S. I'm again with them with multiple sources on each of these, and also each of these have had their statistics increased by a factor of 2 by running reverse through the lattice as well as the forward direction. Okay, so as I say, we've implemented smearing now. Smear the heavy quark with regards to the light quark at the source and at the sink. We've used ground state hydrogenic style wave functions as have been used for Upsilon. I've found the optimal radius of these by finding that which minimises the fitting errors while maintaining a reasonable chi-squared. Again, done by Bayesian multi-exponential fits. And what we've done is compared single correlator no smearing fits to these vector where only source or sink smearing has been used, and to matrix where both source and sink smearing has been used, and to compare the error bars. So the fit function here includes this oscillating term. So the Bayesian fitting has helped to keep this under, does it deal with this. And what we want from these fits is essentially the ground state amplitude. So this has been done at zeroth order, and also we've got the next order in 1 over MB current part and combined them through one loop where the perturbation theory has been done by Junko and our student Emil Gules.
Can I ask a question about the sources? Mm-hmm. When you use a hydrogenic wave function, is the hydrogenic wave function basically fixed, and then the light quark and the heavy quark are independently sourced from that fixed wave function? Or is it actually you put the heavy quark any place you want and convolve it with the wave function and the light quark?
No, we just put, so the light quark is at a point on the time slice, and then you just smear the heavy quark with respect to the light quark.
I see, and then that, so you're basically using the hydrogenic wave function centered at the location of the point source for
the light quark, yeah.
As the source for the heavy quark.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you.
So here's some, this plot is similar to the one you saw with Upsilon earlier, where we've just got the ground state energy plotted against a number of exponentials. So we can see again, once we get to a 7 exponential fit, the chi squareds come down to good values and we get a plateau here. So again, where we could use any of these 4 values as our final fit value. Now here's a plot of so this is essentially the ground state amplitude, and it's comparing smearing with no smearing and also with just source or just sink smearing, and we can see that the errors are significantly reduced when you do matrix fits that include both sink source and sink smearing.
For the sink, you also just put the light quark at a point and then multiply the heavy quark by the wave function centered at that point, or is there more of a convolution there?
What do we do there? I can't remember exactly how we do it at the end.
The upshot is you're using exactly the same operator for source and the sink. So factorizing coefficients can be used. That would be said. Yeah. It's a matter of practicality how you actually implement that.
Yeah. Okay, so here's some of our results for the for phi, which includes the next order 1 over MB parts as well. As I say, phi is, I should have that written here, it's essentially it's FB root MB. Okay, so this is, first of all, let's show the point. So the blue points are from the light, from the lattices, which have dynamical quark mass 0.01, and the red points are from 0.02 lattices. Now, we've just started playing around with these chiral perturbation theories fits, which have been provided to the formulas have been provided to us by Claude Bernard and Chris Alban. So I should point out that because when you do these fits, you can you include points which can have differing MF, which is the C quark mass, and MQ, which is the valence quark mass. But to plot this as a line, you have to fix one of these things so that you can visualize it as a line. So although these red points have been included in the fit, they're not being visualized here by this function because I've set MF equals 0.01 to plot this thing. So as I say, I was just playing around with this. So this is a fit to all of these points, but it's unclear whether these points out here should be included in the fit or not, or whether they're too heavy for the chiral perturbation theory. So here's a fit which only fits to these four points now. So it kind of makes it changes the slope a little bit, but actually the point down here is not changing. So the rest of these fits from number one will just be to these bottom four points. As I say, we've still got to think about this a lot more. So the next plot shows, additionally, the curve which you get if you essentially just do the partially quenched chiral perturbation theory, which includes no staggered effects. I've set the staggered pion energy splittings to zero, and I've turned off the terms which are the A squared terms, the terms that have got lattice spacings in them. So as we saw in Andreas's talk, the staggered stuff really does make things look a lot more linear, especially at these low valence quark masses. It tames this divergence here. So here's the fine lattice results. So we're seeing some discretization errors, about the 5% level here on this quantity. These have not in any way been included in this fit yet. This is just our recent results. But we'll see in the next. So here's a plot of the ratio of the B sub S over the B. In the hope that a lot of systematics will cancel in this ratio. The blue line is the partially quenched staggered chiral perturbation theory, corresponding to the C quark mass of 0.01. So the red and the black points are not represented by this line, but I've also plotted the orange line, which corresponds to the C quark mass equal to the valence quark mass. This is the fully unquenched line. So this black fine result is fully unquenched, so this line should go through there, and it seems to be going through there. And also this point is fully unquenched, so this orange curve represents the red and the black, and also this point, which is fully unquenched. But as I say, we've got what we want to do now is to get another two fully unquenched points at low C quark mass to include in these fits. And we also have to, think a bit more about the best way to do these fits. Okay, so now we'll talk a little bit about BB bar mixing. So here's the diagram. You create a B bar at time, so-called TB bar. You use a four fermion operator at time zero to annihilate it and create a B, which annihilate at time T equals TB. So this, in the continuum, this has contributions from these two lattice currents, which look like this. So we're at a much less advanced stage in these calculations as for the B decay constants. So we've used the same simulation parameters, but we've only so far done one ensemble, the MF equals 0.01, and we've only done it for the B sub S, and we've not, we're in the process of doing the 1 over MB corrections, but we've not got any results for that yet. So here's some more fitting. This is the functional form this time. We can see that there's now two oscillating factors corresponding to the B and the B bar. So here, so again, we've used Bayesian fitting. So here is a, Junko showed plots like this yesterday, where it's essentially, it's a plot of the function versus the fit function versus the data for the correlator with the ground state energy contributions removed. So we can see these oscillations. So here, to plot this in two dimensions of fixed TB equals 10 and varied TB bar, so you can clearly see these oscillations. And here, I've plotted the full thing in three dimensions, so you can see the oscillations in both directions. Okay, so here's this similar plot again, which you've seen twice already. So here again, once we get this time, there's no smearing being used in these fits at all. It's just local. And for this, once we get to 5 exponentials, we get to a reasonable chi-squared and we see the plateau. Okay, so again, in the continuum, this is given by these two lattice factors, and these perturbative coefficients have been calculated again by Junko and Emil. So we get these O, L, and S from the ratio of the ground state amplitude from the four-fermion thing that over the normal two-point correlator amplitude. And note that we directly fit to the three-point without first taking the ratio over the two-point. If you take this ratio before fitting, then you need to wait for a plateau, but here we don't. We're not doing that, so we can still fit it. We can include the low time points in the fit, which makes us end up with a smaller error. So we can get FB root B sub B through this continuum thing. So and it turn we get this preliminary result for that, which I say is preliminary. So we've been cautious with the errors, which the first one is from the fits, and the second one is systematic errors, which include the neglection of the 1 over MB currents and the absence of two loop coefficients. So as I say, we're in the process of doing the 1 over MB corrections. Okay, so to conclude, the upsilon space cross-space results, as I said, provide these parameters, MB and the lattice spacing, as inputs for the B decay and mixing calculations, and also they provide us with confidence because we've compared other quantities to experiment that these methods work. So we've implemented smearing in these B meson simulations, and this has substantially reduced the statistical errors for the parameters needed for FB. The chiral fits, I think, look promising. We need more fully unquenched points at light quark mass. And we need to sort of play around with these fits more and think about them more. We've also started to look at the B-bar mixing correlator, but this is at a much less advanced stage. We need to include the 1 over MB corrections and also repeat this with different C and valence quark masses. So that's all, thanks.
Understand that a difficulty with NRQCD is taking the continual limit.
Mm-hmm.
You're basically assuming that the heavy quarks have momentum that's small compared to their mass, and of course, as the cutoff gets bigger, this will essentially not be true for the higher momentum quarks, wave functions, and so on. Is that something that you can work around, or do you?
Well, I mean, we're just sort of in the thinking that
if
you...
When you compared the two different lattice spacings and saw a difference, I don't know which of those points is correct. It's possible the better answer was on the coarser lattices.
Well, we don't, I mean, do you mean when we saw the difference here?
Yeah, the 2FP.
This one?
Yeah.
But this may not be from... Yeah, I'm not sure exactly how we're going to... We can just say that there's a 5% error here. I mean, we have to just include this as a systematic error. I mean, we're not necessarily going to take extrapolations to the continuum, but as I say, this is the quantity which is really important, and we see that these systematics seem to have cancelled here. So...